It's been said that we are the stories we tell ourselves. Sometimes we are, but other times, not so much. Maybe we got the story wrong or only half right. Maybe we connected dots in ways that didn't really add up. Or we were so busy looking at one version of the future that we didn't see another one coming. We tell big stories sometimes, with big visions, to help us understand trends and movements of money, people, goods, arms, information, sentiment, support. We come up with ways of thinking about entire regions, the Asian tigers, the Pacific pumas, Africa rising. These particular stories are about growth, economic growth. And back in 2001, the then chairman of Goldman Sachs Asset Management, Jim O'Neill, came up with a new story, BRICS. Not the kind you make in a kiln. These were four countries at the beginning, Brazil, Russia, India, and China, that he said were so big, so dynamic, and so poised for takeoff that they would almost certainly be an important part of the future of global economic growth. And for a few years, that sort of seemed true. In 2010, South Africa joined, putting the S in BRICS. That was near the beginning of Jacob Zuma's tenure as South Africa's president, and it's been mostly downhill economically ever since for South Africa.
Having been in finance for nearly 35 years, I know that there is always something you think that won't work out that way. In fact, quite often, I believe that only 60% of what you believe about the future of to do with finance will work out, and that's pretty good.
This is Jim O'Neill talking to China's state-run CCTV in 2014, when some of the BRICS, including China, were starting to look a little wobbly. Around the same time, another story was being told, two competing stories, actually, about what China was doing in Africa. One of those stories, China was investing, building infrastructure, and helping Africans with no strings attached, unless you count voting the way China wanted African countries to vote in the United Nations and other international bodies, and not recognizing Taiwan as a separate entity. The African countries that did all that got significantly more from China. The other side about China in Africa, told by critics both inside Africa and outside, China was embarking on a neo-colonial effort to lease land and extract resources and build strategic influence. In each of these stories, some things were true, others less so. Many Africans do look positively on China because of all the infrastructure it's building in Africa, with more to come under China's trillion-dollar New Silk Road Initiative. That initiative brings Africa into a bigger plan to connect China through new roads, railroads, and ports going all the way to Europe, like the ancient Silk Road did. But there's also still some African wariness about China, disdain about cheap Chinese goods being dumped on Africa, concern about Chinese moving to Africa and taking African jobs or leasing African land in a country that now faces a land shortage. See Jeffrey Gettleman's excellent story on this in the New York Times on July 29, 2017. There's disgruntlement that for all the talk of China having a new kind of relationship with Africans, there's still an awful lot of extraction of raw materials going on, raw materials like oil, copper, and coltan, sent back to Africa as manufactured goods for Africans to buy at a considerable markup without Africans capturing the value added. And then there was the downside of becoming too dependent on trade with China. In 2015, South Africa was the continent's largest exporter to China and its largest buyer of Chinese goods. The relationship was cozy. South Africa's ruling African National Congress even sent its executives to study at the Chinese Communist Party's schools. But in 2015, Chinese demand for African commodities and trade fell off by almost 40%. South Africa was hit along with many other countries. Being one of the BRICS didn't save it. And now, earlier this year, South Africa's economy dipped into a recession. It has almost 28% unemployment. And signs of corruption and bad management by President Jacob Zuma's administration have caused South Africa's credit rating to be downgraded by all three major agencies. It would be safe to say that many South Africans are unhappy with President Zuma. This is the bedlam that broke out in February when Zuma was trying to deliver a State of the Nation address. For more than an hour, opposition politicians rose and called for Zuma to resign.
Shibambu, yes. The president, of this country is going to deliver the State of the Nation address. I'd like to assure you of that.
We are not going anywhere.
So we would like you to leave us in peace.
We are not going.
If you are not going, then we have no option.
Zuma must go. He's the one who must go.
We have no option.
He must address the nation from prison, not from there.
They called him corrupt, possibly a criminal, and certainly not fit to hold office. In the end, police had to carry several of them out so Zuma could talk. So much for this corner of Africa rising brick by brick, at least for now. This is Whose Century Is It?, a podcast about ideas, trends, and twists shaping the 21st century. I'm Mary Kay Magstead. And South Africa's experience in so many ways makes it an interesting case study in how we sometimes get so focused on certain stories about the future that we miss the way others are shaping up. There was the post-apartheid Rainbow Nation story, the hope and optimism inspired by Nelson Mandela's approach to reconciliation and the international goodwill to help South Africa re-enter the world and the global economy. Some parts of that went better than others. There was the story about how China's trade and investment in Africa would help bring prosperity to Africa, Africa rising. In some ways it has. In other ways, progress has been uneven, as South Africans know as well as anyone. And in any case, being overly dependent on external powers has never really worked in Africans' best interests. And finally, the BRICS.
Of the BRICS countries, you've got Brazil, which is in free fall, has been in free fall, and shown its total political economy as an abject failure. We've got Russia, which is entirely status and approach in a country not no one should be emulating anywhere. You've got China as a great success country, but it has its own very, very unique approach to sort of how it manages political economy. You've got India, which under Modi has used the last BRICS summit in Goa merely as a whip for Pakistan. And South Africa, which sort of believes it's created this new sort of G7 counterweight to the West, whatever that is.
This is Martin Davies. He's managing director for emerging markets in Africa for Deloitte. And that's not the only story about which Martin Davies is skeptical. There's the Africa Rising narrative, too.
Well, Africa Rising was simplistic and based on commodities, and commodities always have cycles. And if you're a cyclical-driven economy, you're a hand-to-mouth economy, particularly if you have oil, i.e. oil-propelled. So I think, again, if we look back at the 80s and say Asia Rising, well, that's interesting, but how many Asian countries are rising? A handful. How many countries in Africa were truly putting the necessary fundamentals in place of effective state, reasonable, decent, and improving governance, economic pragmatism, and the enablement of private capital in their economies? Very, very few.
Who did?
I think the smartest guys in the room from the African continent in terms of that were initially South Africa, but subsequently lost the plot.
How did South Africa specifically lose the plot?
I think you have to look at where certain South African politicians come from and their leanings, their education, their perspectives of the world. And arguably, one could argue, the same you could for Zimbabwe, that Zimbabwe's dramatic failure in terms of an economy was a misunderstanding and misapplication of the China model in this part of the world. Similarly, sir, you could look at South Africa, and one could argue that many of the policies put in place from an economic policy perspective have also been lessons that, or experiences taken from China, supposedly, that have been misapplied in the context of South Africa.
Like admiring and studying China's state-owned enterprise system, which, even in China, accounts for very little of China's economic growth. But at least the state-owned enterprises there function and deliver, which is not always the case in South Africa. I wondered what a young South African about to leave university and enter the workforce makes of all this. The economic morass South Africa is now in, prospects for the future, how China's role here is viewed, even how Trump's America is viewed these days as a contrast to China. So I sat down at a cafe at the Witwatersrand campus in Johannesburg with an international relations and media studies senior named Mpo. He has since graduated. He started by saying South Africa's president Jacob Zuma has more than a little in common with Donald Trump.
Maybe Zuma is a watered-down version of Trump. I don't know. In terms of the behavior, you know, not caring for the rule of law, not thinking about certain things that are important to society, making a state about yourself, right? Running it like your own little store where you can fire and hire as you please. Maybe with regards to that, they are similar, right? And it's interesting that we're talking about Trump when South Africa has been kind of in a similar position. But the thing is, we didn't see it coming, right? That's the difference between us and the US. US knew who Trump was, but still they elected him. President Zuma, it was like, you know, he was this person and later revealed who he was. And now it's so difficult to get rid of him.
And Jacob Zuma has been friendly with China, as well as with a wealthy family of Indian investors, the Guptas, who, critics say, he is allowed to get too deep into matters of South African governance. As to what China's doing in South Africa, Mpo is rather pragmatic.
So there's a lot of things that indicate that China is this state that is very selfish, right, and about itself and looking out for its own interests, which, according to the theories of global politics, is the right thing to do. States are self-interested, and, you know, that's China is an example of how a realist state should be, right? That's what I think. But at the same time, I just always get disappointed. Well, I'm sure the heads of states in different countries in the continent wouldn't care. They don't care whether they disappoint me or not. I'm just like there. They don't even know me. But what is interesting for me is some of the decisions that African countries make with regards to trade, with regards to media policies. I don't know, just allowing Chinese businesses to come into the African continent in return for infrastructure, for an example. There could be much exploitation of the relationship between China and Africa from the side of Africa. I just feel like Africa is not exploiting that enough, you know, because we're being exploited here. Instead of getting the Chinese engineers to come into South Africa to carry out infrastructure projects, for example, take young South Africans to go and train in China so that we get to, in the future, manufacture those things on our own and improve our own infrastructure on our own.
On the edge of another college campus in town, another South African is looking at China's engagement with Africa in general and with South Africa in particular within a bigger strategic picture. David Monyai is an international relations specialist and co-director of the University of Johannesburg's Confucius Institute, the Chinese government-funded center for language learning and cultural outreach.
You have to understand that within a changing global order, what is that global order, whether we like it or not. I know it's sensitive to so many people. The U.S. is on the decline as a hegemon. If you look at the U.S., its stake in global economy has drastically been reduced. However, U.S. remains the most powerful country when it comes to military, and I don't think is there any challenge at the moment. But the rise of others, what I call others, because they were not at the core of development in a post-1945 world order led by the U.S. and Western countries. Developing countries have been demanding changes, particularly in the institutions of both political and economic governance. I'm talking of IMF, World Bank, United Nations Security Council. So these issues with much more political representation, democracy, that we cannot continue with the post-1945 world order. So to try to change this and the way of pushing, which is a negotiating strategy, the original BRICS countries realized that to get more legitimacy, they brought in South Africa, and to have Africa at least, so that whenever they talk about change, it has much more gravitas from a political and the need for change. You have Brazil on the other hand.
And, he says, China coming in and giving Africans options and opportunities they didn't really have before is part of that shift. David Monyai was a policy analyst with the Development Bank Southern Africa, helping think of ways BRICS countries could expand cooperation when South Africa joined in 2010. The BRICS Bank, now based in Johannesburg, was one of those initiatives.
So you see these changes taking place with change of administration in BRICS countries, but in the long run, what had drove BRICS country together remains a challenge. And until that change, the view is that either the hegemon and Western countries, if they were smart enough, they would change because they have control over change. But if they leave it, the pressure will come from periphery. The structures of IMF, World Bank will become illegitimate and no one would see. But it's even worse with the coming of the Trump administration, that you can't see the difference between Zuma and Trump. So the issue is that who's driving globalization? None other than China. I never thought in my lifetime I would have a non-Western country advancing globalization.
There it is again. South Africans seeing an uncanny resemblance between their president and Trump. In the midst of this, China coming in to do business seems like a relatively straightforward proposition.
What is it? What is my interest? What is the interest of my country? What is the interest of my continent? My continent has to come out of a terrible history of underdevelopment, a lack of innovation. And therefore, to do that, we have to have a multiplicity of flares. We have to have Western, which is well-established and traditional players. We have to have new players.
Which, he acknowledges, is not to say that Africans are entirely comfortable with the level of Chinese involvement on their continent. Now, some 10,000 Chinese companies, most of them private, along with Chinese government-funded dams, roads, and other infrastructure projects.
I guess the advantage of China interaction with Africa is this new keen interest that even traditional players are rethinking and driven by the competition with China, which is a fair competition anyway. These are business people interest that they have to move in. If they delay, Chinese would somehow have a much more bigger stake, particularly in strategic areas.
The Pan-African nonpartisan research group Afrobarometer found in a survey in 2015 that 63% of people surveyed in 38 countries across Africa found China's impact in Africa to be somewhat or very positive, with South Africans being a little on the lukewarm side. You know, it's not that a Chinese presence is entirely new in South Africa. Some ethnic Chinese have been living there for more than a century, and about 300,000 live there now. Among them is Yushan Wu, a young foreign policy researcher at the South African Institute of International Affairs in Johannesburg. Her parents moved to South Africa from Taiwan before she was born, joining relatives and seeking new business opportunities. Yushan Wu says she sees herself as South African, full stop.
And maybe to the average South African, when you first look at me, you don't necessarily categorize me in either part of the history, right? I feel like I can understand both sides, but it's still complex. I think I started, let's just say that I was in, was it primary school? How would you say that? Yeah. And so this was still around 1994. So we started going to school with kids from all over different backgrounds and races. And you actually didn't notice that you were different until you get older. I guess society or, I don't know, politics or whatever, tell you that you're different. I think society is still very much fragmented, but I think these things take time. One of the first times I traveled to China, and it was a African research delegation, you know, so when we arrived in Beijing, and it was quite funny because, well, for me, it was an interesting experiment because when you say, well, I'm from South Africa and I'm part of the African delegation, the people on both sides were very confused. And, you know, I even got someone who was in my delegation say to me, so where do you think I can go and buy an iPad from? And I kind of had to say, well, you know, I've only been here for 2 weeks just like you, so I don't really know. So it's interesting in that aspect as to, as your own study, to see, you know, what the perceptions still today.
And for me, having lived in Beijing for 15 years, I can imagine because you're caught between two societies that maybe even more than the average have looked at race as a way of defining a person. So like you go to China and they're like, well, you're Chinese. You're always going to be Chinese. And I would never be Chinese, no matter how long I lived in China. no matter how well I spoke Chinese.
And even though you're more Chinese than I am. So it is still something that needs to be worked on. And if we go back to my role as a researcher, I think there's been this case, you know, about Mandarin being introduced in some schools in South Africa and the kind of responses and emotive responses that you got from that. And in a way, I understand because of South Africa's history, and that's something that when foreign engagement happens or partners come to South Africa, have to understand that there is that history.
President Mandela came to power with, you know, a lot of optimism that this would be the Rainbow Nation, that, you know, somehow South Africa would move beyond the era when it was really defining people's identity and value as human beings by what they looked like. How much do you think that's actually happened? Have you seen a change over your lifetime in how people have acted toward you as someone who's of Chinese ancestry?
I think it's interesting. So let's just talk about, for example, my social circle, right? You know, sometimes I think your own friends or your own peers don't realize that they may be making a remark that, you know what I mean, that they may sound, you know, not
racist.
Yeah, politically correct. And I'll say, yes, okay, you're saying that, but actually I'm Chinese. And it's so funny because the response I get is, yes, but you're different. And I think always think to myself, I'm only different because you know me. And I guess there is a bit of an onus on South Africans to also have a more global outlook, because some people say South Africans can be quite parochial. But at the same time, what's difficult is, I think there is, you know, within the Chinese community, not everyone, but generally, you know, we know the Chinese like to keep to themselves and get on with it. And I mean, there have been cases in the past where maybe there've been media headlines on, for example, Chinese taking over, shopkeepers taking over supermarkets, that kind of like the Chinese are coming kind of mentality.
But not all South Africans feel that way. Some think if the Chinese are coming, that's only good. People like Shay Smith, who was a diplomat in South Africa's embassy in China a decade ago and is now heading efforts to bring Asian trade to Cape Town. He's with the Western Cape Investment and Trade Promotion Agency, WESTRO.
10 years down the line, how far have we come? And I think we can only look at the current forum on China-Africa cooperation to really understand the strength of the relationship. And I do think it's a very strong relationship, and it's a growing relationship. They invested $60 billion. Well, let's not say invested, but they pledged $60 billion to the African continent over the next 3 years. That's a substantial amount and a substantial commitment by China and the Chinese people to Africa. Are we on target, though, to utilize those funds aptly? I think that is one of the core issues within the African Union itself they have to try and understand, because there is funding available, but my concern was always, are we able to access this funding for the right projects, which will not only benefit regions, but the entire African continent.
And there too, Shay Smith says, the Chinese are willing to help.
I find that the Chinese are extremely more willing to cooperate and to help than what other partners have been. And I say that because a lot of the times we do sit around a table and we really don't know how to unpack this project and how to actually get the money and then drive the project forward. And the Chinese, at least in terms of for South Africa, have really been willing to say, okay, you know what, we will bring the specialists to help you understand what it means to do a project and what you require should you go forward in advancing this project. Rather than say, here's $10 billion, please use X company, and then after that we will talk. So I think on that level, optimism was extremely high, and I think we're now riding on that wave. The question is can we ride that wave, which is in the interest for all of Africa? And I think that's where I also sit sometimes, and I wonder, are we doing enough, fast enough, for Africa? We can see the frustrations all around in many African countries. We still need to grow. We've got a huge infrastructure backlog.
Because at this point, he says, the Forum on China-Africa Cooperation, which started with a huge summit and big promises in Beijing in 2006, has led to big investments on the continent, but not always to ones that best benefit Africans, as opposed to benefiting Chinese trade and resource extraction.
I have not seen, I know they did a review of the Forum on China-Africa Cooperation earlier in February last year, but I've not seen any tangible commitments that have come out of that in terms of very hardcore projects or investment projects that have been identified for for Africa itself, other than the usual ones that they often have, which is building of a high-speed rail or construction of buildings and enhancement of ports in various places.
And, of course, it must be said that China is not alone in skewing its aid and investment in ways that benefit its own economy. Many Western powers have done the same thing over time, first as colonial powers, certainly, but even when giving aid more recently. Tied aid, as it's called, requires that the recipient use the aid to hire companies from the countries giving the aid.
And we always know that there's no such thing as a free lunch, but how can we as Africa or as South Africa leverage off the pledges that we've been given at the best opportunity for our people? Now, if it means that we as a body, as the African community, must come together and have identified projects, which we have done, then we need to put the resources around that to say these are the top 20 projects in Africa that we have identified, and this is now what we need to drive. My only worry comes in now is that if you start to have, say, 60 billion and every country is going through economic turmoil at the moment, or almost every country here in Africa, the growth is very low, what is it that you want to do to try and get part of that 60 billion? Because if we don't come together as a unit, then maybe I can do this alone. And I'm wondering, I've not yet seen it, but I'm wondering if you get to that stage where eventually China might turn around and say, well, look, you know, we really need to spend this money, and country X and Y have decided they've got this project, so we're going to put 10 billion there anyway. And then the question would be, has that money benefited a country, a region, the Africa? A concern would be if we don't get our house in order in terms of how we can capitalize on these projects, agreed in consensus basis, we may end up fighting for a big portion of the 60 billion US dollars for our own interests. And that, I think, would be a concern for me.
Shea Smith's job is to think about how to make Cape Town and the Western Cape prosper, to boost growth and create jobs. So for him, China's offer of loans and investment is a potential means to that end.
The government has a very close relationship with China. And so you generally hear very little criticism of China coming from the government.
This is Cobus van Staten. He co-hosts the China in Africa podcast and teaches media studies at Witwatersrand University.
However, from civil society and opposition politicians, there's a lot of criticism. And that criticism isn't only leveled at China, but it is leveled particularly at the relationship between the ruling party and the government. So sometimes China kind of uses a stick to beat the ruling party, and that happens in other African countries as well. So it very much depends on where you sit, you know, kind of in the kind of power and resource hierarchy, because China tends to favor elite relationships. But there is a very kind of ambivalent response to the China-Africa relationship coming from Africa, you know, kind of a twinned expression of, yay, this could be great for us, and also, oh, this could be problematic in the future, you know, and it very much kind of pendulums back and forth.
So for the people who are critical, the opposition or civil society, what are the criticisms?
There's a bunch of criticisms. One being that China is entrenching whatever political party you happen to be criticizing, so that they entrench incumbents, that they're making it difficult to move unpopular presidents or parties out. Also, a lot of anxiety about debt, that mounting debt, there's a kind of a debt bomb waiting for Africa in the future. Anxieties about low levels of refinement of African resources. Anxieties that Africa is again trapped in a relationship where they are exporting raw resources which are processed elsewhere and then get re-imported as manufactured goods. You know, to be fair, China is to a certain extent sensitive to that particular issue. And some, like, facilities for processing some of these minerals and, you know, oil and so on are slowly being put up kind of over Africa. But, you know, that. And then also a lot of anxiety about the flow of African wildlife to China. The, you know, the illegal smuggling and poaching of ivory, rhino horn, pangolin scales, rosewood. Also, kind of a free-floating anxiety about what China is. You know, China is so far away, such a kind of mysterious entity. It's different from a country like India, you know, which has a long history of Indian diaspora populations living in Africa and quite a kind of fine-grained organic relationship between the two countries. I think a lot of Africans are still mystified by China. They don't really know exactly what to make of this growing relationship. They just see big signs with Chinese writing. And that brings out this kind of visceral kind of reaction sometimes, which frequently turns into a lot of weird urban legends about Chinese involvement.
Such as?
The most pernicious one, and researchers have been fighting against this for years because there's no grounds for it, is a story that Chinese prisoners are exported as laborers to Africa. Some of it comes from the fact that Chinese infrastructure construction compounds tend to be incredibly well secured. They have these high fences around them and guard towers and so on. There's been this kind of assumption that that is because they're a bunch of prisoners that were brought to Africa who are now taking African jobs. Whereas the real story, I think, is security concerns from the Chinese contractors. So they are actually trying to keep Africans out rather than trying to keep the Chinese people in. China has a very strong power as this generator of crazy stories. There was a scandal last year in Uganda where doctored, like photoshopped pictures appeared in this newspaper of what looked like human corpses being processed and then canned and exported to Uganda. So it was the poor Chinese ambassador had to come out and say, no, we're not shipping human meat to Uganda. And so on, you know, it's every now and then there's this kind of like this kind of flare up of some kind of rumor, you know, that you can see China really plays this weird, unstable role, a lot of different kind of roles at once, and one being this kind of mysterious entity from far away.
That's as opposed to the United States. Koba says American popular culture is widely embraced in South Africa in particular, and in Africa as a whole.
You know, kind of like all the music on the radio, all of the, you know, the celebrities, especially obviously African-American celebrities who have a massive cultural impact in Africa. You know, all of my students, for example, they all listen to Kendrick Lamar, they're all obsessed with Beyonce. It's, you know, so that kind of cultural presence. But it's not really followed up by the actual physical presence of Americans here or American companies here. The only real physical presence that shows up occasionally, and not in South Africa very much, is a military presence.
So it's a real missed opportunity.
Yes, you know, if engagement with Africa is on one's list of priorities, then that is a missed opportunity. I think the West as a whole have not yet made a leap where they see real opportunity in Africa. I think they tend to be stuck in a way of thinking where Africa is essentially a big set of problems that they have to solve, that they have to find space on their kind of busy agendas. You know, kind of, so, you know, it's like on our long list of people we need to help. That itself has become a very kind of sour position for Africans to be in. And I think in that sense, the Chinese engagement is very, very powerful because it just presents a different way of thinking about Africa. That is not just, oh, you poor people, we need to help you with aid. That way of thinking about Africa, I think, Africans have become quite sensitive to that and also quite tired of it.
And when it comes to U.S. attitudes toward Africa and how the United States is seen in Africa, South Africa in particular, we're back to that persistent point that it doesn't help that the current U.S. leader reminds South Africans of their own dysfunctional leader.
There's huge, huge disillusionment.
This is John Stremlaw. Over his long career, he's been a senior policy planning official at the U.S. State Department. He's worked with the World Bank, the Rockefeller Center, the Carnegie Commission on Preventing Deadly Conflict, and the Carter Center, all organizations that have helped build American soft power in the world. Soft power, that means the power to attract, to make others want to emulate you. Now, as an international relations professor at Witwatersrand University in Johannesburg, he's been seeing a different wave of sentiment.
And what I keep telling my South African friends is, remember the anti-apartheid struggle. You built, the democratic forces built alliances to civil society in the United States, to corporate interests, to colleges and universities where students went home and told their dads, your company's trading with, complicitous with apartheid, and to the point that the sanctions against South Africa was the one vote that was overridden in the Congress that Reagan had vetoed, if you remember. So that there should be an appreciation here of the diversity of America and listen carefully. But then also that American predominance was on the wane anyway. You know, the National Intelligence Council's latest assessment of global trends says that we're in a world where it's multipolar, where the United States is no longer the indispensable country. Now that Trump is reminding people that, in fact, America can be more of a problem than part of the solution, more of an antagonist than a partner, it's important for South Africans and everyone else to look to themselves, to reassess what is best their interest and their values, and then to work with other like-minded partners. This is a very important and big point for South Africa and South Africa's democracy.
Because in those heady days after apartheid ended and Nelson Mandela became president, South Africa had its own soft power, and it aspired to more, to becoming a model for its neighbors of how to be a successful African democracy.
And so the articulation of a vision for Africa, which was more self-reliant and integrated, was premised on the fact that it's so a diverse continent, 54 countries, that there ought to be voluntary association and cooperation, and that the regional organization, the African Union, which has now become, should have at its core a commitment to civic nationalism, to democracy and democratic processes, not for some abstract ideal, but because if you are going to deal with conflicts that are overwhelmingly within states, not between or among states, you had to get inside people's politics to prevent humanitarian crises and to prevent UN interventions and foreign interventions, to give Africa pride and dignity, so that all African states now are obligated under the African Union Constitutive Act to have periodic regular elections. We know these elections aren't necessarily free and fair or really good and up to standards, but at least they are on the books as committed to having their citizens have some say over how the country is governed. South African leadership in this regard was extremely important under Nelson Mandela, who showed such generosity of spirit, but also toughness in dealing with the strong and dominant white minority. It could speak with a soft power moral authority in the continent. That voice is lost now. South Africa is not playing that kind of a role. South Africa welcomes Bashir here to the African summit. That's a betrayal of its best qualities, its strong suit in international relations, which was to be as the leader of an increasingly democratic Africa. It made South Africans proud to see their country seen as a voice for an African renaissance, for an Africa that could look to the north, to the industrialized countries, and say, look, we may have disadvantages, but we're human beings, we're proud, we expect to be treated with respect, and in return for that respect, we will be more transparent, we will be more accountable.
So that story hasn't turned out the way many anticipated. Nor has South Africa's membership in the BRICS, nor even, really, Chinese investment in South Africa. All these stories may yet turn in a different direction, but much depends on having good governance at home, good partners abroad, and good models to look to in terms of how to become a good model yourself. China has, to some extent, put itself forward as an alternative model to the United States, competent, technocratic, pragmatic, and yes, authoritarian, rather than messy, fickle democracy. But Africans aren't entirely buying it. In that Afrobarometer survey done a couple of years ago on African attitudes toward Chinese involvement on the continent, for all of China's aid, trade, and investment in Africa, more Africans still said that the American model was the one to emulate. China's came second. That's it for this time. Thoughts, comments? Send me a message on Twitter. I'm at Mary Kay Magstad. That's MaryKayMagistad, all one word. Or send me a longer note at whosecentury@gmail.com. You can find the print version of this story and all of our other episodes on our website, pri.org/century. This is episode 50, so there's plenty to choose from. We're also on iTunes and pretty much wherever else you get your podcasts. Whose Century Is It? Is a co-production between me and PRI's The World in cooperation with the BBC World Service and WGBH. It's funded by a grant from the Henry Luce Foundation. Back soon with another episode. Thanks for listening.